Our first case is, our first argument, I should say, is a consolidation of three different cases for purposes of argument. This is Avalos v. U.S. 21-2008, Abrantes v. U.S. 21-2021, and Martin v. U.S. 21-2255. Mr. Stern, you have 20 minutes for argument, and I understand that you reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. Is that correct? And Mr. Dayan, did I pronounce that correctly?
Dayan.
Mr. Dayan, I understand you're going to argue for 12 minutes, and then you're followed by Handy Barakowitz, Heidi Barakowitz, and who will argue for 6 minutes, and then you reserve 2 minutes of that time for cross appeal.
Right, and that's Ms. Barakowitz's cross appeal.
Okay. Tell me that again. That's who?
I'm just saying the cross appeal will also be Heidi Barakowitz.
Okay.
Because it relates to the Martin case.
Yeah. All right. So let's get going. Mr. Stern?
I think that it's consistent with protocol for me.
Yeah, can take it off.
All counsel can remove their mask. Paul, are you?
Thank you, Your Honor. All agree that the Fair Labor Standards Act is properly interpreted to require prompt payment of wages, although the statute does not contain any explicit requirement. And the issue here is whether that implicit directive is violated when payments are made by the federal government following an appropriations lapse in accordance with the express requirements of another federal statute. The Anti-Deficiency Act has always precluded payments during an appropriations lapse, and in 2019, during the last appropriations lapse, Congress added the explicit requirement that employees who are required to work during an appropriations lapse shall be paid for such work at the employee's standard rate of pay at the earliest date possible after the appropriations lapse ends, regardless of scheduled pay dates and subject to the enactments of appropriations ending the lapse.
Why shouldn't we presume, though, that when Congress extended the FLSA to federal employees, I think sometimes in the 70s, with full knowledge of the Anti-Deficiency Act prohibitions, which have been in place for probably 100 years, that they intended to allow for damages if the FLSA was violated?
In some ways, Your Honor, I think the question is sort of the reverse, whether there's any reason to think Congress, given that background, would have meant that. And again, we have an explicit requirement. This is an implicit requirement. And while we all, take that very seriously, I don't want to in any way cast doubt on that. But it's also, even at the time that Congress, was extending the FLSA, I think it was 1974, to federal and state governments, even at that time, what the Supreme Court had indicated was that there was going to be, a flexibility in the statute. It had been applied in situations in which there had been, a two-year delay. I'm not suggesting that, you need a two-year delay. I'm just pointing out that there had been sort of a, position of flexibility. Congress would have had no reason at that time to think that there was, that if the federal government agencies complied with the specific directive, that at that point they would be sort of willy-nilly violating the law. I mean, and it would be an odd situation to say that a statute with criminal penalties, which you better not violate, but by doing that, you violated a different statute. And then again, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I was just going to ask, because I think this is right, but I'm a little unclear what both sides' positions, and I'll ask your friends about this. I assume the government's position is that if the FLSA contains the prompt payment requirement as found by the trial court that you have to be paid on your next regular payday or something like that, your view is that that's just not capable of being complied with in the event of a lapse of appropriations because the Anti-Deficiency Act prohibits it. Is that correct? Or do you think if we affirm the trial court and say that not, despite the ADA, you still are obligated to pay under the FLSA prompt payment, that that would give government agencies permission to actually pay even in the event of an appropriations lapse?
We certainly do not think the second.
I assume that's the case. So if we affirm the trial court, then what we're essentially going to be saying is that when Congress extended the FLSA with full knowledge of the Anti-Deficiency Act, it intended its subject itself to double damages, liquidated damages, every time there was a lapse in appropriations.
That's absolutely correct.
But that would not be automatic. It's still at the discretion of a court to award liquidated damages.
That's true, Your Honor, but again, we talk about that, you know, of course, also. But like the first question is, would Congress have ever meant this to happen? I don't think anybody really thinks Congress ever meant that. And in 2000, it's almost impossible to square that with the 2019 legislation. Remember, it's the entire federal workforce that doesn't get paid. I mean, there's like a subset of people who are both covered by the FLSA and are sort of deemed to be, you know, quote, you know, essential workers. But everybody, including me, doesn't get paid in that period. So Congress is like, so when Congress like a sort of tried to provide a level of assurance to all employees, both the persons who were like who did work and the employees who did not, and it said very specifically, when do you get paid? So we have an absolutely clear congressional directive saying this is when you get paid and this is the rate at which you get paid. And then the assumption has to be that, well, Congress also understood that the people who performed work are going to get paid double the amount. Everybody else is just going to get their usual rate. And I don't think that there's really like any correct basis for coming to that conclusion. And
let me ask you this, because there's two parts here. Even if the damages are discretionary, the violation would be automatic.
Because if
the government can't pay because of the Anti-Deficiency Act, they're violating under the trial court's understanding of the FLSA. I know what prompt payment means is another issue. I'm just assuming that the trial court's
that's
right here.
Correct.
The violation would be automatic. So we would at least be assuming Congress intended for an automatic FLSA violation when it had extended it. And your only defense for liquidated damages under the subjective and objective prongs is the Anti-Deficiency Act itself, right? You don't have any other, well, we could have done this to pay them, we could have done this to pay them, we took steps to figure it out. We know what the Anti-Deficiency Act says, we've known what it said for over 100 years, and the only argument you're ever going to put forth for good faith is the Anti-Deficiency Act itself.
That's correct.
So if that's the violation, then relying on that seems questionable as whether it's good faith.
I mean, obviously.
Or it's just a big circular argument. It's a violation, but it's also automatically good faith as a matter of law.
Yeah, I think that that's right, and I think it goes to underscore why it's not a violation in the first place.
Can I just ask you this? Because I looked and I didn't see anything. There are tons of OLC opinions about the and GAO opinions about the Anti-Deficiency Act. Has anybody ever asked them about this intersection between the FLSA and the Anti-Deficiency Act, to your knowledge?
I don't know that question. I know that in past, it's not in the record. I know that in past, shutdowns, the Attorney General's office has sort of looked into whether there was any way to, pay, during that, under the Anti-Deficiency Act, and concluded there was not. I don't understand anybody, and I don't think that the Court of Federal Claims thought that agencies could have paid.
Oh, no, I don't think that. I mean, my reading of all the OLC opinions is that they're consistently, you cannot pay these people, even if they're emergency workers and have to work. I just wondered if there was anything affirmatively saying that's true, even despite the FLSA prompt payment requirement.
I'm not aware of any, and I personally didn't try to research that, but I know other people.
So just to be clear, you're not arguing that the FLSA was not violated, or you can see that there's been a violation of the FLSA here.
No, Your Honor, we're not conceding that, because while the general practice is certainly, and this is the practice that the government always adheres to normally, is to make payments on the usual pay date. But, and I think that the Second Circuit's decision that we discuss in our briefs in the case of Rogers,
But that didn't happen here. The employees were not paid on their pay date.
That's correct, but again,
isn't that a violation right there?
No, we don't think so, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court has also said that, going back to like its first cases, it's like it says, look, like if you had trouble, right, just, you know, for one reason or another in calculating it, like, okay, you still have to try to do that promptly. You're not off the hook. You can't say, well, I didn't make payments because it was hard. You've got to do stuff. But the court also said, but, you know, like, you know, and I quote it from this, like, the FLSA does not require the impossible. And it's, and that's sort of a general precept. And when you bring it back to the specific context of two federal statutes, and so again, what is it that Congress believed it was doing when it extended the FLSA? Clearly, it made the statute's requirements generally applicable. The federal government, like, adheres to those requirements. We're not questioning their importance. There's a very narrow, specific question here about what happens in the event of an appropriations lapse, which is governed very specifically. It always has been. And now, on top of everything, we have Congress saying, this is when you make the payment. So one would have to conclude that Congress says, this is when you make the payment, parentheses, we know that that, of course, is going to be violating another federal statute. We don't think that there's any hint of that anywhere.
So in your view, do you think there's some kind of impossibility doctrine or something like that for the prompt payment gloss on the FLSA?
Yes, and the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said that back in the 40s.
Right, so in that instance, it's not that the violation is excused, it's that there's no violation.
That's right, and whatever the bounds of, like, the impossibility requirement, here you have the additional point that what we're looking at is, like, another federal statute. It's not just that it's, you know, some sort of impossibility.
It's not that the HR manager was out sick that week and didn't get the payroll done.
That's right.
It's not that people didn't sign the time cards. It's, in this case, in fact, it's about as impossible as you can get, because it's barred by a statute that has criminal penalties.
Right.
Why wouldn't we say that Congress recognized even that instance, that there'll be situations where there's a lapse in appropriations and a certain period of time may go back, but then it recognizes, as the Supreme Court also recognized in the Brooklyn case, that time here is important too. And it's not enough for an employee to get paid in time, but if time lapses and they don't get paid in time, then they should get paid a little bit more in order to account for that lapse.
I mean, there are a couple of things. One, Congress is dealing with the overall federal workforce, and there's no way most of that federal workforce, like, and this imposes, and we're not suggesting that this doesn't impose hardships on people, but it imposes hardships on everybody, whether they're working or not. This is the issue, like, that Congress had, like, was trying to get at.
But obviously, some people are not working, then they don't get paid. It's the people that have to show up to work or that are working that we're dealing with here in this case.
Right. But if we go back again to what would, like, we are talking about explicit statements and requirements in a statute as opposed to a implicit requirement that has been understood to have great flexibility in it, and that really called the court's attention to Judge Calabresi's decision.
Before you go there, though, yes, I agree with you. I just don't see in the statute this impossibility clause that you're hanging your hat on.
Well, we're not hanging our hat on impossibility, like, alone. We're hanging our hat on the importance of reading these two federal statutes together in order to discern whether Congress in these circumstances exposed the federal government to double payments. And remember, this is
I think what you're saying though is that any time that there's a lapse of appropriations, that this clause of the FLSA does not come into play, because it's impossible for the government to have complied with the law.
And it's not just that it's impossible for some, I mean, that's correct, but it's also important.
Yeah, show me where that impossible clause is in the statute.
Your Honor, there is no impossible clause. What there is...
There's also not a prompt payment clause either, is there? These are both court glosses on the statutory text.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And with respect to impossibility, isn't there always also the opportunity on the government's part to seek a special appropriation?
The government can.
But it's not necessarily impossible pay these employees in a timely manner.
An
effort could be made to obtain a special appropriation to cover that.
I mean, Your Honor, like a government shutdown to suggest that, like, in the, like, you have a deadlock, and the idea that, like, in this deadlock, there was going to be an appropriation to pay people. The whole point of the, like, of this, of the lapse is that the government can't spend money, and that affects the public and employees in all sorts of ways, puts enormous political pressure on the political branches to resolve their conflict. And
if they could get a special appropriations, they would just get a regular appropriation.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. If the question was, can I pay employees, and all you needed to do was to say, how about, like, exempting from, like, the general appropriations lapse, why don't you say we can, like, why don't you appropriate money? And the whole point is that they've got big appropriations bills covering all these different agencies that are sitting there. So I don't think that's a realistic, like, sort of scenario.
Not even for the essential employees only?
No,
Your
Honor.
Not an appropriation across the board. I certainly agree with you. That's a practical impossibility. But an appropriation for those essential workers that were required to work.
I mean, Your Honor, the circumstances of, like, the shutdowns, I think, I don't think that this is essential to the statutory interpretation question, but I also think that the circumstances of the government shutdowns have been such that the idea of Congress appropriating money, like, on an agency by agency basis, which is how these things are usually done.
Didn't Congress recognize that when it passed these statutes? It said, we recognize that in our own folly, us, Congress, will come. There'll be times where we're going to shut down the government for whatever reason. And then what? It goes on and says, and if that happens and the employees don't get paid on time, and that's okay?
Basically, I mean, okay? No. Like, does it subject the government to sort of liquidated damages when there's a shutdown? And a shutdown of whatever length. I mean, you know, the theory here, like, is not dependent on sort of, like, longevity. And look, I think the answer to that is no, Congress didn't do that. Congress never thought it was doing that. And the, like, it's sort of a, like, it's a theory that sort of, like, finds no basis in what Congress has said. We have explicit limitations, explicit affirmative requirements.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're going to restore your rebuttal time to your full 5 minutes.
Thank you so much.
Let's hear Mr. Dan.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs in the Avalos case as well as the Abrantes case. I'd like to use my time to discuss the Avalos case. Ms. Barakowicz will address the Martin
case. Can I just ask you this? Sure. Do you agree that there's no legal way to pay these people during a lapse in appropriations?
Yes, but...
So if that's the case, then the crux of your argument is when the FLSA was extended to federal employees by Congress in the 70s with 100 years of the Anti-Deficiency Act in existence, they intended to subject themselves to the possibility of liquidated damages when they themselves couldn't agree on an appropriations bill.
I think that's right, and I want to be clear. What's impossible is once a shutdown begins, obviously, and there's not an appropriation, then no government agent can process the payments.
They can't be paid.
Right. That is true. And
do you think that that's a logical inference that Congress intended every time it goes into a shutdown, which occurs frequently and it has occurred? I mean, they're horrible. I hate them. I mean, I've suffered through some of them myself and didn't get paid and had to work. But do you think that as a logical matter, when Congress extended the FLSA, knowing about the Anti-Deficiency Act, it said, well, despite the Anti-Deficiency Act knowing this, and we're going in a shutdown for various political reasons or sometimes debt reasons, we're still going to allow employees to seek liquidated damages as a matter of course.
The short answer is yes, but the longer answer is that...
There's nothing in the legislative history or anything suggesting right?
And that the longer answer is that, as Your Honor has acknowledged, that Anti-Deficiency Act case law was crystal clear, as was the pre-1974 prompt payment by payday case law and administrative regulations, an unbroken line of cases. And I think the lesson of the Supreme Court's recent Bostock case is that if the statute's text compels a certain result, the fact that Congress may not have contemplated the particular fact pattern should not allow the court to impose a policy view on Congress.
This isn't a policy view, though. This is the strictures of the Anti-Deficiency Act. So they're automatically rendering something a violation per se.
But the policy, this is the critical point here, I think. I think this is where the rubber meets the road. The policy of the Anti-Deficiency Act has never been to cancel or even modify.
We're not talking about canceling the obligation. They get paid eventually. We're talking about whether they are also still reinforcing the prompt payment gloss on the statutory text in the same way it's applied in regular circumstances, or whether the Anti-Deficiency Act provides a different gloss in the case of the shutdown.
So I think the right way to analyze this is if you start with the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Why do you start with the Anti-Deficiency Act? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, this is the government's
position. You start with the Anti-Deficiency Act.
I'll tell you why I think you should start with the Anti-Deficiency
Act. No, I agree. I thought you were going to say start with FLSA.
No, I'm sorry. If you start with the Anti-Deficiency Act, it's crystal clear now from the case law. This is where the case law couldn't be clearer. It does not and should not be read to give the federal government a get out of jail free card for underlying statutory and contractual obligations of any kind.
Right. So when an obligation has already been committed to and agreed to under some kind of statute, Congress cannot then say in an appropriations rider that you can't use appropriate funds to pay for that. Right. That's Maine Community Health. That's all kinds of things. But that's not the situation we have here. They have not yet, at the appropriations lapse, these people have not yet accrued an obligation to be paid. They're being working during the appropriations lapse.
Oh, but.
And there's no rider saying they can't, that obligation is being erased. It's just that the prompt payment portion is being interpreted differently.
No, by working. And by working during.
But the government is not arguing that that debt is canceled, or that they can't be paid for that obligation. The government will concede to you, I'm sure, well, maybe not, but I would assume they would concede that the underlying pay statutes, not the FLSA, require these people to be paid for work.
There's no principal distinction for purposes of the Anti-Deficiency Act and appropriations case law between the right to be paid the amount of their base wage, okay, and their right to be paid under the FLSA. Those are both statutory obligations that attach to work performed. So, and I don't hear the government making the argument you're articulating, and I think they don't make it for good reason. Well, which is that it proves too much. It would suggest that no one had to be paid in any of the prior shutdowns. And by the way, I should say,
I think that probably is an argument. If they didn't work, that they may not have to get paid.
No, no, no. The people who worked in every shutdown.
Yeah, but that's based on the underlying pay statute.
But a pay statute no different from the FLSA in principle for purposes of Anti-Deficiency Act analysis.
But we're not talking about the underlying obligation. We're talking about whether there's a violation of the prompt payment portion and what it means to be prompt payment.
Sure.
So those cases you cite me about Maine Community and all those things, I don't think they say anything about how you read the court interpreted prompt payment portion. If you're talking, those cases are all about the underlying obligation.
I think what you first need to do is figure out what the underlying obligation is. In Maine Community Health,
underlying obligation is you get paid in a timely manner. But what a timely manner is in the context of a government shutdown might be different than in the regular course of business.
Let me suggest this.
You're saying no, right? You're saying Congress automatically intended for there to be a FLSA violation in the event of a lapse of appropriations.
Yeah, I will say
that's the logic of your argument.
In 1974, there hadn't been any shutdowns.
Can I get a yes or no on that? If they extended the FLSA under your interpretation of the prompt payment the prompt payment interpretation that the courts have put on it, despite some of the other court cases that seem to go the other way, then Congress intended for there to be an FLSA violation every time there was a lapse in appropriations.
Congress wrote a statute that would dictate.
Congress intended. This is what we're looking at. We're looking at when Congress writes a statute, we're looking at what their intent
was. And I think Congress, let me try it this way. The answer is yes, that Congress intended that every bit as much as Congress intended in the Affordable Care Act to pay insurers. And I would submit this case is stronger than Maine Community Health for this reason. In Maine Community Health, it could not have been clearer from the subsequent appropriations that Congress didn't want those payments made. There's nothing like that here. So the question is, does the FLSA create an obligation by an employer? Let's take the government out of it for a second, then I'll bring them back in. If this is a private employer, does the FLSA say to that private employer, hey, if you're facing budgetary difficulties...
I don't think this analogy is going to help me because the government is just different, right? The government has principles of sovereign immunity. It has the Anti-Deficiency Act. You can cite those private cases. You can even cite that Brooklyn case, which I think involves state employees all you want. The federal government is different, and this is interpreting two conflicting federal statutes. It's not interpreting one federal statute that overrides everything else.
Right, and the reason I bring up the private example, I won't dwell on it, is that if the answer to that is yes, then the only reason the answer is different here is because of the Anti-Deficiency Act and nothing else. So now let's look at the Anti-Deficiency Act case law.
Let me ask you a threshold question then. Is there anything in the Anti-Deficiency Act that prohibits liquidated damages?
No. There is nothing in the Anti-Deficiency Act that would prohibit the payment of liquidated damages as soon as there are appropriations available, which happens when shutdowns end. So the way that you can make the policies of both statutes work, this case shouldn't be too complicated. It's an interesting case, but it shouldn't be too complicated because you can make the underlying policies of both statutes work by acknowledging that the government official or agent who is regulated by the ADA can't make that payment because he'd be, you know, violating the statute. But those same ADA cases, and this is another important concept in them that I think is crucial, those cases say that the ADA only regulates the agents of the United States and not the United States itself. That's why the United States' obligations survive, even when there's no appropriations.
Only if we assume that Congress intended that, though. Because the other way to make this make sense is to recognize that in the context of a lapse in appropriations, that Congress considers timely payment to be when the appropriations are restored. In fact, Congress made that pretty clear when it amended the ADA in 2018 or 2019 by specifically directing that.
Well, I disagree. I think the GEFTA statute simply addresses something. It's an amendment to the ADA itself. It's not an amendment to any of the FLSA. And
yeah, but don't you think it's pretty telling that when Congress amends the prohibition statute, that it specifically instructs when it considers payment should be made?
And what's interesting is it says, and it makes perfect sense. It says pay them as early as possible. It doesn't reference the FLSA at all. And this
isn't
is crucial.
That because I think if they understand that the FLA is not implicated.
No, I don't think it's fair.
I mean, this is a hard case because obviously if we actually asked the members of Congress, nobody is going to say that they understood this to be a question. So what we have to do is look at canons of construction and see which one weighs
right.
in favor one way or another. And I also think we have two different competing canons. And so it's very difficult to get at what you think Congress would have intended. But it seems unlikely to me that Congress, knowing what it's why it uses government shutdowns and how they happen, that it would automatically intended for an FLSA violation to occur every time one happens. I understand you have the competing argument that and that your side has, which is, yes, they did, and they want to pay people that worked during that damages.
Yeah, and that, by the way, is let me say this is an important point about GEFTA. There is no indication from the legislative history, and it's sparse, but it's a number of floor speeches where member of Congress after member of Congress gets up and says, the least we can do for people is to get that check to them as soon as the shutdown ends and not later. That, I would submit, is perfectly parallel to the Langston case. It's an old case, but it's then cited and developed further by the Supreme Court in Maine Community Health. And in that case, the court held that when the government owes...
Which case are you talking about?
I'm talking about Maine Community Health read together with Langston, which it cites and then explains. What the Maine Community Health, the government argued, because that subsequent appropriation showed that Congress didn't want those insurers to be paid, that should be an excuse. And in Langston, Congress appropriated less than the amount of the person's original statutory salary, and the government argued in Langston, Congress said pay him $5,000. What more is there to the case? That's what he's due. That's what Congress said. That's Congress's intent. And the Supreme Court in Langston, and then again in Maine Community Health, says, no, that's not how you look at it. Where there's an underlying substantive statute that confers rights on third parties, the failure of the government to appropriate the full amount is on the United States government eventually. The agents don't have to pay it during that lapse, but when that lapse ends, the United States, as the obligor, must make those payments.
Okay, you're out of time.
Okay.
My colleagues have any questions.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counselor Brockwich. Yes, I'll wait to you. Your time allocation is 6 minutes, and you reserve 2 for your cross-appeal, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you may begin.
May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of plaintiffs in Martin and Mars. I'd like to start by addressing the notion that this was an impossible situation.
Are you here for the Border Patrol people?
No, sir.
Oh, that was them. Okay, so I lost my questions on that. What are you here for that's different from what we just heard?
Sure. I represent plaintiffs in Martin and Mars.
The names don't help me. Give me the factual scenarios.
Those are the cases arising out of the 2013 government shutdown. So in that case, the other cases are here on an interlocutory appeal in response to the government's motion to dismiss. In Martin, the court ruled both that the government violated the FLSA and its failure to do so was not in good faith. And then also address the willfulness issue in Mars.
Okay, so we've already got a stipulated damages in your case because it went to final judgment.
Correct.
So the Anti-Deficiency Act arguments are raising are applicable, but you have a separate willfulness argument because some of your people missed the statute of limitations?
Correct. So I'd like to address the impossibility discussion that you were having earlier this morning. I think it is incredibly important to understand that this was not a situation beyond the government's control. The government shutdown is something that the government itself caused to happen. And there are steps that the government...
We can't get into those facts or that those circumstances, right? We're not going to review why the shutdown happened, correct? I mean, we're only reviewing here that the shutdown happened and we go forward.
Yes, correct. But the government would have you believe that this was a situation beyond its control, that it was impossible, that its hands were tied because of the Anti-Deficiency Act. And that argument just completely ignores over a century of precedent that the ADA does not erase the government's obligations, such as those that were created when they...
I don't think the government's arguing that it erases the obligation to pay these people. It's arguing that when the shutdown ends, its immediate compliance with the Anti-Deficiency Act and its requirement to pay as soon as it ends satisfies the prompt payment obligation of the FLSA. So these erasure of obligation cases don't really address what the government's arguing. They are not arguing that Congress can come in after a shutdown and say, oh, well, because we saved X amount of dollars during the shutdown, nobody gets paid even if they worked. Those cases would apply there, and they would lose on that. The question is, does the compliance with the Anti-Deficiency Act's requirements to pay as soon as the shutdown ends comply with the prompt payment text of the, not text, gloss on the FLSA?
The two statutes can be read together.
They can be read together both ways, right?
In 1974, when the government... extended the protections of the FLSA.
You know you're going over the same ground we just went over with your opponent. If you have a separate argument on willfulness that you want to preserve and you're less than 5 minutes left, you might want to make that. I understand those arguments. We just went through them. Your argument is a plausible reading of how the two statutes work together. The government's argument, I think, is a plausible reading, too.
Yes, I would like to address the good faith and willfulness inquiry. I would just like to leave you with the point that when Congress extended the protections of the FLSA in 1974, it also extended the liquidated damages provision to the federal government, just it applies as does any other employer in the country. Here, the United States cannot overcome the presumption in favor of liquidated damages because it neither acted subjectively in good faith by making an adequate inquiry or objectively and reasonably
believed. What kind of adequate? I mean, we all agree that the government could not have paid these people during the lapse in appropriations. So what kind of inquiry would you have them make to comply with the subjective good faith thing? They already knew they couldn't pay them. So do you want them to submit some kind of what inquiry to whom and what does it ask that would fulfill that requirement?
Yes. As a preliminary matter, I disagree with the suggestion that the government the FLSA is a strict liability statute and its violation.
No, but we're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about the liquidated damages and the subjective and objective good faith provisions. And the trial court found that they didn't show subjective good faith. What do you foresee that they would have done to do that would have been found to be subjective good faith?
So here the government should have conducted an inquiry and it should have taken three things into consideration. It should have taken into consideration the over century precedent interpreting the ADA as not canceling the government's debts.
But not to comply. Their inquiry is, how do they comply with the prompt payment provision? Because that's the violation, right? Who would they have asked to say, how do we comply with the prompt payment provision in light of the ADA? And the answer is going to be, in every single case, I think, unless you're arguing something different than your friend on the same side did, the government could not comply with that during the shutdown.
The government had options. Had it conducted that inquiry and looked to its own Department of Justice, it could have either concluded that it was in violation of the FLSA or it was not in violation of the FLSA. If the government...
Who cares if it considers it's in violation or not? Is it complying with it? They know they can't do anything about it. So does it matter if they undertake an investigation that says, look, if somebody says, no, it's good faith to comply with the Anti-Deficiency Act or no, I mean, they have to comply with the Anti-Deficiency Act, right? There's no way that they can pay these people. So that's the inquiry they have to take, right, to show that they're complying with it is, have they undertaken steps to comply with it? Well, they can't comply with it.
So under the...
You agree that they can't comply with it, right?
I agree that they, during the lapse in appropriations, individual government officials were precluded under the ADA from making wage payments to the employees.
And those are the people that we look to see whether they have subjective good faith.
The FLSA was extended to the government as an entity. The United States government as an entity is defined as the employer under the FLSA. And here, in the 2013 cases...
Yeah, but in FLSA cases, when you look to who had the subjective and good faith, you're looking to the intent of the government officials making the decisions about pay. I mean, that's the kind of evidence you put on in your run-of-the-mill cases. Did this person make this inquiry about whether overtime was due or whether they're getting the proper, you know, extra pay rates or stuff? You have to look to somebody. It's not just the amorphous government out there. It's who's implementing the pay decisions.
Here, the government stipulated that the entirety of the United States government, no one made an inquiry about whether it was in compliance with the FLSA. And when you look at the test for whether liquidated damages...
But what difference would that inquiry have made?
Because the government had options. Had they consulted with their experts at the Department of Labor and looked at the case law arising out of, for example, the State of California budget impasse, and had they done that inquiry and can come to the conclusion...
Let's assume they did that and the Department of Labor said, you're subject to liquidated data damages. The response is going to be, okay, but we still can't pay these people.
They had two options.
Is that good faith?
They had two options.
No. So you're the one that started with the DOL suggestion. So let's stay with that. They go to DOL, and they get an opinion. I don't know whether DOL opinions are relevant to, frankly, the executive branch anyway, or whether you would go someplace else. Let's just assume they are. And DOL says, we've looked at this, and you have to pay these people, and you're going to violate the FLSA. And the response is, okay, thank you, but we still can't pay them. Is that good faith?
I would argue no. They would be able to meet the subjective element of the test that they made a good faith inquiry, but they would not be able to show that they acted with a reasonable belief that they were in compliance with the FLSA. But
that's the problem, right? Whatever inquiry they undertake, in your view, if they comply with the Anti-Deficiency Act, they violate the FLA, and there's no way out for them under the good faith problem.
There are steps that the government could have taken. The executive branch could have asked Congress to pass legislation such as the Pay Our Military Act that was actually passed in 2013 to ensure that military personnel and the civilian federal employees who support them were paid during the budget impasse. Or had the Department of Labor and the United States government as an entity determined that it was a violation of the FLSA, it could have determined to pay, that the FLSA requires part of the substantive provisions of the FLSA.
Are you allowed to say that the government could have determined that despite the Anti-Deficiency Act, it was going to pay these people?
Absolutely not, sir. After the lapse in appropriations ended, the government could have complied with the FLSA by paying the liquidated damages that are required under the Act in this situation because they were not acting in good faith. And they could not, if the Department of Labor had said...
What makes a difference if they pay liquidated damages or not? That's what they have to pay if they didn't act in good faith.
Well, certainly they would have, one, treated the federal workforce correctly. There were employees who were severely harmed by the government shutdown.
Don't get me wrong. I know I'm somewhat not agreeing with your position. I was a government employee for nearly 20 years, and I lived through many of these shutdowns. It is an extreme burden on people who have to come to work and people who don't have to come to work. I have absolute sympathy for all of your clients. But the question is, I fail to see how we can think that Congress would have intended for to subject itself to liquidated damages every time it had a shutdown. And there's nothing the government can do, absent appropriating funds, which is the whole reason for the shutdown, that there's a dispute about that. Absent that, in your view, there's no way they could have complied with FLSA. So it is an automatic FLSA violation and an automatic award of liquidated damages every time the government shuts down to people who worked. That's the end result of your legal theory, isn't it? Because it sounded to me like you agreed that there's no steps they could take that would establish good faith if they didn't pay them.
I do agree that it is that the FLSA is a strict liability statute and it's a per se violation. I think that in 2013 there are steps that the government could have taken.
It's strict liability, but it's still up to the discretion of the court. is it not, to award liquidated damages?
It is only up to the discretion of the court to reduce or eliminate liquidated damages if the government can meet its burden with regard to both prongs of the test for liquidated damages, whether it's subjectively and objectively acted in good faith.
And in your view, compliance with the ADA is legally insufficient as a matter of law, for objective good faith at least?
Yes.
Okay, you're out of time. Have you addressed your counterclaim arguments in that period of time?
Yes.
All right, so let's hear from the other side. Mr. Stern, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Be brief. My friend on the other side began by referring to the commands of the inability of the court to disregard express statutory language. There is no express statutory language.
What's your best case for the notion that the regular understanding of prompt payment doesn't always have to be in a regular payday? There are cases, I know you cited them, I don't recall them, but what's the best case for that?
What I would refer the court to in particular is the Second Circuit's review of the case law in its Rogers case, in which it goes back over both the Supreme Court decisions and other Court of Appeals decisions, and sort of to make the point that there is no, and this really is the case. I mean, and the Supreme Court had made that clear back in Walling in 1945. There is no absolute strict liability if you miss a payday. I mean, again, what the court there, was sort of a case in which, the court ruled, ultimately, for the plaintiffs.
The court did recognize that in the event of a shutdown or something, that the failure to pay the statutory minimum on time was, that can be the reason for double payments to be made because of the delay that's caused.
Excuse me, I'm not sure which case.
It's in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Savings Bank versus O'Neill.
First of all, there wasn't a federal statute and it was a 2-year delay.
But they interpret the FLSA in the same context we're looking at.
With respect, Your Honor, it's not the same context.
It's a federal statute and a state statute.
That's
not
right.
Two competing federal statutes.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that makes a big difference in how one would interpret this. What we know is Congress has spoken explicitly to when payments should be made after a shutdown concludes. And that is a statement, and yes, the legislative history shows that Congress was concerned, about the impact on federal workers, but the legislation, addressed and the statements addressed all federal workers. I mean, it's an enormous workforce, and again, there's only a subset who are both essential and FLSA covered, but the impact is felt by everybody, and that's what Congress was recognizing. But it also, to any doubt, it explicitly said the people who are required to work.
What is it that they saw Congress recognizing, the impact on the government or the impact on the workers?
The impact on the workers, Your Honor. I mean, everybody, understands, including us federal workers, that missing a paycheck is no joke. And that's, and the government, adheres to, the sort of, pay on a regular payday, sort of, in normal circumstances. It's a narrow question of what happens when the federal government agencies follow an express congressional directive, make the payment in accordance with that express congressional directive, and then somebody says, well, that's fine, but it's not consistent with an implicit requirement in another statute. So notwithstanding statements about paying at the base rate, you have to pay twice. and, you know, also giving federal workers sort of a huge incentive to go, I'm the one who, like, has to come here because, like, none of us is getting paid, but I'm going to get paid twice at the end of this. I'm not suggesting any bad motives in that, but Congress is looking at the entire spectrum, and there's, but the real question is just going back to the very beginning, like, in Walling, which specifically said that where there was the question, one of the many questions was a three-year delay, and like one of the many questions had to do with, like, the ability to calculate. And the plaintiff says, well, we should be off the hook because of those difficulties. And the court says, no, like, Section 7A requires only that the employees get, like, the required premium as soon as convenient or practicable under the circumstances. And the court says specifically that the FLSA does not require the impossible. And of course, as Your Honor says, there's no impossibility clause, but the same judge-made doctrine, you know, about prompt payment also includes recognition of that kind. And most important, that's the Supreme Court, and that was the understanding of the law.
Why would the payment of liquidated damages in recognition of the delay that the Supreme Court spoke about in the case that I mentioned to you, why would that not be applicable here?
Well, I think, like, for two reasons. I mean, one, we could talk about why it's factually distinguishable, but more important is the fact that it's a federal statute.
We have a lapse, and now the employee has been made whole. They received their pay at the time once Congress was able to pay them, right, or appropriate, and then the payments could be made. So now the employee has been made whole, except for the fact that they have suffered a delay. And why is it at that point in time that, why is it an impossibility for the employee to get liquidated damages at that time?
Well, the question isn't whether it's impossible to get liquidated damages later. The question is whether it was impossible to make the payment promptly. I mean, those are two different inquiries. So, of course, like, it's possible for the federal government to do things later.
But liquidated damages assumes that there's been a violation of FLSA.
That's right. But nobody's saying that it's impossible for the government to later make a payment.
So if there's a shutdown, there's a violation. If the employees don't get their paycheck on time, it's a violation, albeit it's impossible for them to have prevented that from happening. But now I'm talking to a different time period here. The employee has been received their pay, and they've been made whole in that regard. Why is it impossible at that point in time for the employee to get paid the liquidated damages in view of the delay? Not what was actually owed to them. For the delay that was caused to them.
Right. I mean, we're not saying that would be impossible to do. The question is whether that is in fact.
That's not what you're saying is impossible. What you're saying is there is no violation for not paying on time because they paid as soon as possible.
Exactly.
So there's no violation that would allow for the grant of liquidated damages.
That's right. And
we can disagree with that, of course.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. But that actually, I just want to make sure.
But you're not, saying the liquidated damages are impossible. In fact, if we find a violation, it's likely we're going to award liquidated damages.
I was trying to get to the point to understand whether liquidated damages were impossible. And so the answer is no.
That's correct.
That's correct, right?
That's correct.
There are instances where liquidated damages are appropriate.
Yes.
And there's instances where they're appropriate when there's been a government shutdown.
Not when there's been a federal government shutdown.
I'm not talking about in this particular case. There are instances where liquidated damages are appropriate when there's been a government shutdown or a lack of appropriation.
Not in the case of the federal government, no. I mean, I want to make that clear. Like, it would not be the case. And
so you're saying there's no scenario that you can think of where liquidated damages would be appropriate, where that scenario includes a shutdown or lack of appropriation.
That's correct, Your Honor. What the federal government's obligation, and hence, I think, like, what the prompt payment requirement means.
So give me a scenario for liquidated damages would be appropriate.
I mean, I can imagine, you know, I don't want to concede anything, but like say we could have the very different case of, I think Judge Hughes was, you know, offering some examples of just, you know, sheer carelessness or, you know, worse yet, some sort of willful design not to make payments on time. I mean, that's a very different question. And, you know, but what we have here is when nobody can make the payments. Congress has said this is when you make the payment. If we want to look at the specific language, that's the specific language that governs this case. And to say that the implicit requirement of a prompt payment should be interpreted to say that the federal government pays twice in these circumstances, we think is simply wrong.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I believe we have your argument. Thank you very much.
We thank all the parties for their argument.
I think they've reserved some time.
Yes. 2 minutes.
He didn't really address the willfulness. Hmm? Or cross appeals on willfulness. He didn't really address it.
Well, let's do what Jesse's talking
about. On willfulness? So why on willfulness, which is your cross appeal, is acknowledging that there might not be good faith, but everybody knew that they couldn't do that. Why is it willful to comply with the Anti-Deficiency Act?
So the test for whether or not the government's violation was willful was whether they showed reckless disregard for the matter in which its conduct was prohibited by the FLSA. Prohibited by the FLSA, not the ADA or any other statute.
How can it be reckless disregard when the government officials are complying with a statute that has criminal penalties?
So the criminal penalties,
What would they have had to do to not be willful? We're getting back into the same thing as the good faith stuff. There is nothing they could have done differently, is there? Absent paying them, which we all agree that they couldn't have done.
Again, I agree that it was a per se violation of that.
You're basically arguing that every time there's a lapse in appropriations, there's a violation, you're entitled to liquidated damages, and it's going to be willful because there's nothing the government would have done differently, and there's nothing the government will ever do differently in the future because of the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Well, certainly I agree, that's my position, but even if you were to disagree
Think Congress intended that? Congress knows of lapses of appropriations that have occurred throughout the entire history of this country. Do you think they know that they're going to happen again. Do you think they ever intended any of this to happen when they extended the FLSA? The lapses in appropriations often occur because of budget showdowns. And so you have to assume that despite the fact that they occur over budget showdowns, they intended to add more money to the deficit and require more expenditures from the government.
When Congress extended the protections of the FLSA in 1974, it was very clear what the case law was longstanding that the Anti-Deficiency Act did not erase the government's obligations.
Just like to get you back to the willfulness thing, though. In your view, is there anything that they could have done to show no willfulness?
In this situation, I don't believe so, but especially in 2013, the government stipulated that it made no inquiry. So even if you disagree with me on that point, in 2013...
I know you're hanging your hat on that inquiry, but we all know that the inquiry would have been fruitless because they're not going to do anything different than they've done. I mean, we all know this. This is an established fact of shutdowns going back, at least in my memory, to the early 90s and going back many years before that, before my memory. And I mean, there's plenty of LLC opinions out there on this. You can't pay these people. So no inquiry they make is going to turn out differently, right? It's fruitless.
This is no different than a private employer that...
Oh, I think it is. A private employer does not have another federal statute prohibiting them from paying stuff.
If a private employer were to hide funds so that it couldn't pay wages on time, the government would not accept that as acceptable. And here, this was a situation of the government's own creation. There didn't need to be a budget impasse. There didn't need to be a political dispute. And even if there was, had they done the inquiry, there's at least two steps that they could have taken. They could have passed legislation such as the Pay Our Military Act that they passed in 2013, or as we discussed earlier, they could have determined to pay the liquidated damage provision and make the employees whole.
Thank you.